According to the 2010 U.S. Census, Montana is among the whitest states in the country. That means 90% or more of the population is Caucasian. But does that mean Montana is free of the racial friction that has surfaced across the country? For the next hour, we'll look at the reality of race in Montana. You'll hear six-word essays on race from people around the state. You'll find out where the concept of race came from and how it's played out in Montana history. We'll look at implicit bias and why Native Americans and other minorities are overly represented in the state's criminal justice system. You'll hear about the experiences of three African American students who moved from Southern California to Montana, and you'll meet some people who are dedicated to changing the lenses we use to view minorities. I'm Ray Fanning, and that's all coming up on Facing Race in Montana. Students at the University of Montana gathered six-word essays on race from around the state as part of the Montana Race Card Project. And as you'll hear, they paint a complicated picture of the state's racial attitudes.
Never sure which box to check.
That's Kathy Weber-Bates' six-word essay on race.
We were never really sure which box to check when it came to asking census or questions about our race, because our dad is German and French descent, but our mom was Polynesian and our features are Polynesian.
Weber Bates was born in the Bitterroot Valley.
I was asked often, as were my siblings, so where are you from? And you know, we'd say Stevensville, and that, no, where are you really from? That wasn't a hugely challenging experience growing up, but I think it was more of seeing at times my mom be treated as a second-class citizen.
She says her mother managed the family's money, and she remembers going to a bank with her parents when she was pretty young.
The banker didn't want to acknowledge my mom. She only wanted to acknowledge my dad. And my dad kept deferring to my mom because she's the business manager, but she was also brown and had a thick accent. And I don't know. To this day, I always wondered, was that because she was a woman, or was that because she had brown skin, or what was going on there?
That incident stayed with her when she was teaching a diversity and media class at the University of Montana. She wanted her students to learn to be respectful and to include a wide range of voices in their reporting.
I kept running into people who shared a similar sentiment, something along the lines of, how do you teach diversity in Montana? So I wanted to take those statements and turn them on their head, because we just know that's not true. Not everyone is white in Montana.
That's when she discovered the Race Card Project. It was created by former National Public Radio journalist Michelle Norris. Norris had asked people to think about the word race and to distill their thoughts, experiences, or observations into a six-word sentence.
You know, there's no small print here. It's boiling down the essential components of your experience related to race.
The students were excited about a Montana version of the project, and the class reached out to Montana campuses and tribal colleges.
Within a few days, we had more than 100 essays, and that encouraged my students to say, hey, there is something here, and hey, people do want to talk about race.
They presented some of the essays during Diverse U Week at UM.
The essay that impacted me the most was from a 25-year-old female participant from Bozeman who submitted, "What are you? I'm a person."
"When will Native American lives matter?" And this is from an anonymous woman in Fort Belknap.
"Don't tell me there's no problem." Tierra, Missoula.
Francine in Browning writes, "An invisible barrier holding you back."
"The root of racism is fear." Anonymous, Missoula.
"Not white? You're not treated right." This is from an anonymous man in Bozeman.
"Columbus Day shouldn't be a holiday." Anonymous from Fort Belknap. "You don't even know the real me." From Jalen and Haver.
Eventually, about 300 essays came in, and the writers could add a note with some context if they chose.
"Blind eyes don't fix the past." This is from an anonymous woman in Bozeman. In her note, "I see white people who say it isn't their fault for what happened, but the stories of our ancestors can't be put on a shelf to collect dust. History does not work that way. The lives of our forefathers colored the lives of our fathers, and their lives have colored ours. The pain I feel for my heritage doesn't go away because you close your eyes. It just gets torn anew." "Say white privilege. They stop listening." This is from a Bozeman woman. In her note, No one likes to hear that they're racist, but this place is full of subliminal racism, and you wouldn't even know unless you're not white.
Big Sky secretly masks small worldviews. This is from Joan Billings. In his note, in Montana, people like to pretend they're colorblind. Racial tensions can be easy to overlook when they aren't a lot of races in general.
When you look white, but aren't. Note from the author, Sarah in Missoula, says, it's a weird in-between having mixed-race parents. I carry the stories of my grandfather picking fruit during his childhood in California. My Mexican-American mother was the only brown girl in her white neighborhood school. How do I tell these stories when no one thinks of me as a person of color?
Weber Bates says some essays, like the last one, dealt with the difference between perception and reality.
We had several people participate who said they were Native American, but they have blonde hair and blue eyes. And there was tension internally because they would see some of their friends or family treated differently but than they were, even though they felt like they were exactly the same. So that kind of laid bare this concept that race isn't always what you see, but it's what you experience, and it's our attitudes that carry on the concept of race.
And some essays questioned the concept of doing the project at all.
This is from Cassie in Bozeman. Race is not an issue here. And her note, there's your six words. Why are you making it an issue?
Weber Bates says she can understand where those feelings come from.
Certainly, there were plenty of people early on telling us, why would you even do this? Why would you stir something up? And the truth is, people had lots of reflections about what they were seeing nationally and what they'd experienced personally. So if this exercise helped to get that out in the light and help people to talk a little bit more about it and come together, or at least understand another person's point of view a little bit more, to me, that's on the right track.
Some essays fully embraced that understanding.
Color doesn't change how I feel. This is from Cynthia in Chinook. Her note, I discovered something new about myself when my mixed race grandchildren were born. I didn't see race. All I see is love in my grandchildren's eyes.
We are one race, human race, from Blake in Missoula.
It's not just an exercise in getting things off your chest or complaining or highlighting someone else's racist behavior that you experienced. It was an exercise in compassion for those who had thought race is not an issue in Montana.
That compassion comes through in the essays, but so do pain, anger, fear, and resentment. So how does a society begin to address those deep-seated feelings about race and discrimination?
We can't just look forward without coming to terms with what's happened in the past, hence the expression, the way out is back through.
That's Tobin Miller Shearer. He teaches history at the University of Montana, and he's the head of the African American Studies program. He's referring to a principle of the Mafa movement. Mafa is a key Swahili word that means great tragedy, and it's come to describe the transatlantic voyage that brought Africans to America as slaves.
It's not that we go back to the past in order to be mired in guilt or paralyzed by historical trauma. We go back to the past not just to remember it, but to understand it so that we can move forward in a far more productive way that builds on the lessons and tragedies and, in some cases, horror of that past to ensure we won't repeat them again.
One of the ways that Shearer encourages that is by explaining how the concept of race came to be.
Super lucky today to have Dr. Tobin Miller Shearer here. Let's give him a nice round of applause.
Thank you.
Students packed the Sentinel High School library during Diversity Week to learn about race.
Let's talk about where the idea came from. Now, if we go back to antiquity and we look at a document, we're going to choose, in this instance, the Bible.
Shearer reads a passage from the book of Revelation that refers to nations, tribes, peoples, and languages, but not race.
Race is notably absent. And the reason race is notably absent isn't because the writer of Revelation just didn't want to talk about it, because the writer of Revelation couldn't have talked about it. The idea of race didn't exist at the time the biblical text was written. It's in none of the documents of antiquity. Race is a modern phenomenon.
He explains how the idea started in the 17th century with a Frenchman named François Bernier. He categorized humans in the same way scientists had categorized plants and animals. The difference was that human classification included a hierarchy based on skin color, with brown and black-skinned humans at the bottom.
There's no better plants and worse plants. There's no better animals and worse animals, but there are better humans and worse humans, according to those racial taxonomies, every time.
During the lecture, Shearer introduces the next important figure in the evolution of race. Friedrich Blumenbach was a German scientist in the 18th century.
He came up with a system of race that every one of you know. Scientific term for someone who looks like me.
Caucasian.
Caucasian, yeah, you've all been taught it. I'm going to change the form a little bit, and we're going to say that I'm a caucasoid. What are the other oids? Caucasoid is associated with?
White.
White, good. Negroid with?
Black.
Color black. Mm-hmm. Mongoloid with?
Yellow.
Yellow is the color associated. Australoid associated with?
Red.
Red or brown, right.
Shearer says the idea of race came at a time when colonial America needed cheap, exploitable human labor. That's where commerce and law enter the story. The settlers couldn't exploit the native population because genocide and European-born diseases had decimated the tribes. And so they looked to Africa and to the bottom of the race hierarchy.
What does that look like? How do we get to the point where African Americans and other people of color are at risk simply by their race?
Shearer says the legal precedent that allowed slavery based on race began in the Virginia colony with an African named John Punch. He was an indentured servant. That meant he had agreed to work for a certain amount of time to pay off his passage to the New World. Punch and two other indentured servants who were Europeans escaped, but were recaptured. As punishment, a judge increased the length of indentureship for the two Europeans, but made John Punch a slave for life.
It's the first time we see in U.S. legal code or its precedent a distinction by race according to the punishment that was given out. So John Punch is given a much more severe punishment, even though he's committed the exact same crime as two men of European descent, the only distinction being he was black and they were white.
By the end of the lecture, Shearer has drawn together the forces of religion, science, commerce, and law that coalesced into the social reality of race. And that's raised questions among the students.
How did the Native Americans get worked into the hierarchy when they were discovered, quote, by the, you know, Europeans?
What are your other ones? Yes, sorry.
Were there competing ideas of race from other parts of the world?
Good. Mm-hmm.
Why do we still judge based on race when we have evidence that race is only a skin color?
Okay. Some of it is to do because we've built up systems and institutions based on the idea of race without understanding what it is that we did. So in our country today, when people say we want to do something about racism, the first answer is, let's just get along. Let's just be friends with people. But what that does is ignore the hierarchy of race and the necessity of getting at that root. So my argument is that for much of our 20th century, we've simply looked at human difference and thought we could get better at being friendly, but we haven't dealt with the underlying problems of power and privilege that this system of race put in place. All right, well, I think I'm going to stop there. Thank you for your attention.
As the students head off to their next classes, Shearer hopes they carry the idea that race is a biological myth, but a social reality.
So basically what I'm wanting to do is to approach the problem of racism with the question of hierarchy foremost in their minds, rather than just the question of how are we different than each other. Because that question of hierarchy is going to get them to a much more sophisticated understanding of race that the question of diversity or difference simply won't take them.
An understanding he hopes stimulates discussion and helps them find their way out of the issue by going back through it.
It's a choice. It's not magical. It's a function of people speaking up, people pushing back, people creating a future that they want to live in.
In the same way economics played a role in the development of the idea of race, it also factored into the way racism played out in the Montana Territory and later the state.
The Crow, for example, immediately welcomed the arrival of fur traders into the Yellowstone Valley in the early 1800s.
University of Montana professor Jeff Wiltsey is writing a new history of the state.
The relations between Montana Indians and fur traders in particular was mostly very, very cooperative and very, very friendly.
He says when the Lewis and Clark expedition ushered in the fur trade, it set up an economic partnership with the tribes that offset cultural differences.
The fur traders needed the native trappers to bring in pelts, and the native trappers needed the fur traders to get access to manufactured goods. And so there was a mutual dependency.
Wiltsey says that partnership helped overcome conflicts between the natives and the newcomers.
What some people would call perceptions of racial difference didn't prove to be very significant. And you see that in intermarriage, you see that in the adoption of cultural practices, significant cultural interchange, the creation around fur trading posts of multicultural, multiracial communities.
But he says the economic boom of the gold rush shattered this coexistence a few decades later when it created a direct competition for the land.
The native people still wanted to have access to the food resources that they'd relied upon for centuries and centuries and centuries, whereas the Americans wanted to drive native people off of that land so they could then prospect for the gold.
Wiltsey says it was during this time that racial animosity toward native people became particularly apparent.
The government's Blackfeet agent at the Fort Benton Agency was a man named Gad Upson, who in his writings back to Washington, D.C., would characterize the Blackfeet, and I quote, as degraded savages. That's the perception of native people that becomes hardened during the gold rush.
He says that portrait of native people as uncivilized became the justification for taking their land and for attempts to eradicate their culture. It was also economic competition that led to conflicts with hundreds of Chinese who came to Montana to find their fortunes at the time.
The gold rushes to the west corresponded with famine in China, with overpopulation, with a terrible civil war.
Ellen Baumler is the interpretive historian at the Montana Historical Society. She says that by 1870, there were more than 600 Chinese living in Helena alone. That was more than 20% of the city's population of 3,000.
You know, the Chinese, this large group, really made huge contributions to territorial Montana.
Baumler says because the Chinese often worked in groups, they could profit from gold claims that others had abandoned. But Chinese workers also helped complete the Northern Pacific Railroad from St. Paul, Minnesota, to the Pacific Coast in 1883. Baumler says Railroad President Henry Villard hired thousands of Chinese workers. But the hatred for those workers is evident in a painting at the Montana State Capitol.
At the head of the Grand Staircase is the painting that commemorates the driving of the Golden Spike. So if you look at that painting, there's Ulysses S. Grant with the sledgehammer. There's Henry Villard there in the front. There are Native Americans over whose land the tracks crossed. There are workers, Italian and Irish workers, with their bowler hats held up in the back. But there's not a single Chinese in that painting. The Chinese were really hated. They were discriminated against in terrible ways.
Wiltsey says the roots of the Chinese discrimination also come back to economic competition.
The perception was that Asian workers would work for lower wages and thus depress wages. They would take jobs away from white miners. And again, what you see is that the racial animosity and racial prejudice is largely directed towards preventing the Chinese from competing with Euro-American miners.
And that helped force Chinese workers into jobs white men didn't want.
Especially jobs that were considered to be women's work. And so that's a large part of the reason why Chinese men would open laundries, why they would open restaurants.
Unfortunately, there was a problem with that because they competed with women. It was one of the few things that women could also do. And so there were very few opportunities for women. They also passed a special tax on Chinese laundries, just Chinese laundries.
Later in 1909, Montana passed an anti-miscegenation law that prohibited marriage between races.
These laws started in the South and were an attempt after slavery to prevent blacks and whites from marrying. And then Western states began to adopt it, and then they broadened it to include Chinese and Japanese people as well.
Baumler says men made up the majority of the Asian population in Montana, and the anti-marriage law was one reason that population declined. The number of African Americans in Montana never rivaled the Asian population. But black trappers worked the fur trade and later herded cattle. Some came to farm and others served in the military. In 1866, Congress created 6 all-African American regiments that became known as the Buffalo Soldiers. Baumler says some of those units were stationed in Montana.
Basically, Buffalo Soldiers were sort of like the Chinese. They were given the worst jobs in the most remote places, guarding telephone lines and in these remote posts in Montana and stuff, and they were really never very much at the forefront.
African Americans saw other discrimination as well. In 1872, the territorial legislature voted to segregate black children in schools. That law was in effect for 11 years. The state's African American population began to fall after 1910, and Baumler says it was about jobs.
Many African Americans served during the World Wars. When they came back, there were no job opportunities, and so families dispersed and moved away.
Montana's African American population continued to fall until about 1960. Today, minority groups make up about 10% of the state's population, with Native Americans comprising the largest group of about 6%. But the FBI says ethnic or racial animosity motivated half of the state's 20 hate crimes in 2016. Most of those were assaults or intimidation. But racial minorities also face more covert forms of discrimination that are often invisible to the white majority. Dustin Monroe carries a tribal banner onto the floor of the Adams Center during the grand entrance of the annual Kiayo Powwow in Missoula. He's a member of the Blackfeet and Assiniboine tribes, and he works to preserve Native tradition.
If we can get back to who we are with our language, our culture, these will be things that help fix our communities, but then also being a part of society.
He's worked in all 7 of Montana's reservation communities, fostering economic development and jobs. Monroe served in combat in Iraq, and he holds a business degree from UM. He's also the founder of Native Generational Change, an advocacy group to push for what he calls intergenerational mobility.
My grandparents before me, they didn't speak English. My grandma was born in a teepee. My other grandma, she was born out in the prairie. And so it's like, that's my people. Like, it's not so far from me. Like, I grew up with the stories of boarding schools and how that they used to do my grandparents.
Monroe says he also grew up with an awareness that he was viewed differently than most of his Great Falls High School classmates. He was one of 5 Native Americans in the class of 2000.
Society will always let you know that you're not part of them, right? Like, if you go, like, into the mall, like, in Great Falls, 4 more Indians aren't allowed to walk together. But I've seen 4 white kids walk together. Never nothing. But when we walk together, they come and they break you up.
Monroe says Native students are often bullied for expressing their culture.
Kids with long hair, a lot of white kids tease them, you know, or do the, you know. It comes into our schools and we learn the concept of race at such an early age compared to others. Like, we as Native American students, like, have to have, like, our guard up. We can't just always relax.
Montana has seen several racially charged incidents at schools over the last few months. One involved a homecoming event at Polson High School. After that incident, Monroe helped lead an anti-racism rally at the school. The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana spoke out about the Polson incident, and it's investigating a case of alleged unequal treatment of Native Americans at a Reed Point High School basketball game. The ACLU has settled a case brought on behalf of a Native American student group at Montana State University Northern in Havre after an incident there. ACLU Executive Director Caitlin Borgman says no one should think that Montana's relative lack of diversity means that it's free of racism.
We do have people of color, and the issues are exactly the same as everywhere else. There's police profiling, there's discrimination in education. People face this discrimination every single day living as a person of color in Montana. And in some ways, I think it's I don't want to say it's more challenging than in other places, but it has unique challenges.
Racial tensions do show up as a factor for hate crimes in the state. The FBI's latest available numbers for 2016 show race or ethnicity motivated 50% of the hate crimes in Montana, while in Idaho, 60% were racially motivated, and in North Dakota, the number is 87%. But Borgman says these overt actions, or macroaggressions, are likely dwarfed by the number of small, often unconscious actions or microaggressions directed at minorities.
Well, you know, race is so complicated. Race discrimination is so complicated. We know it happens on conscious levels, but we also know that there's implicit bias.
I could commit a microaggression and I might not be aware I'm doing it. And it could be reflective of some implicit bias that I have.
Justin Engel is an assistant professor of management and marketing at UM. He studied implicit bias at the University of Washington. That concept refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious way.
They are associations held in memory, so those memories have to be generated through a variety of things. It could be things you see, things you encounter, information you hear, or personal experience. Maybe their only exposure to other groups is through the media, through word of mouth, through other images that they encounter. So the media plays a big role, particularly in creating associations with groups that you have a lot of personal exposure to.
Engel gives the example of a 2004 hiring bias study where researchers answered job ads in Boston and Chicago with identical resumes. The only difference was the names of the applicants. Some had white-sounding names and some had African-American-sounding names. Those with white-sounding names received 50% more callbacks for interviews.
In general, implicit bias, however, is predictive of certain behaviors. It has pretty good predictive validity, meaning if you hold an implicit bias, you tend to act a certain way. Implicit bias is not the same thing as racism. It is a stronger association of a group with a certain concept. That might be a stereotype.
The ACLU's Caitlin Borgman says to combat unconscious biases, Montana needs to focus on education.
I think every level of government needs implicit bias trainings, from teachers to police officers to our legislature. I mean, anybody that's involved in the government would benefit from implicit bias training. We are in control of our conscious actions. And if we know that we have unconscious biases, then we can be extra careful and question ourselves when we are doing things related to race relations in some way.
Justin Engel's advisor at the University of Washington helped create what is called the Implicit Attitude Test. It's designed to measure implicit bias in various areas. You can find the test by searching for Project Implicit online.
There's one that measures how strongly you associate European American faces or American Indian faces with the concept of foreign. An American Indian is more strongly associated with foreign, which, yeah, I'll let you sort of figure out that irony.
The irony isn't lost on Dustin Monroe.
They try to subcategorize us because it's easier for them to subcategorize us and marginalize us and call us like certain names or whatever rather than actually call us Americans.
But Monroe says he doesn't let that discourage him. And if he has to kick down some doors to win acceptance and a seat at the table for Native Americans, he's happy to do it.
I feel like change has to happen. But if we don't start talking, then it doesn't happen. And if I have to be like the bad guy, my dog loves me, my family loves me, you know? If you really want to be a change maker, you can't just get along with everybody.
He says he's also encouraged by a promise from his cultural history.
In our prophecy, in a Hunk Papa prophecy, it actually says that the red people will bring all people of all colors together. It doesn't say we'll just bring ourselves and we'll come out of this. We're going to bring all people of all colors together.
Coming up after the break, we'll look at Montana's justice system and why minorities are overly represented there. Plus, you'll hear what it was like for three African American students to move from California to Montana. You're listening to Facing Race, made possible by support from the University of Montana and its School of Journalism. The U.S. Census doesn't consider Montana to be the most white state. That would be Maine. But Montana is considered the least black state. It has an African-American population of less than 1%. But it didn't stop three students who left their homes in Southern California to pursue an education at the University of Montana.
I was a little bit apprehensive because it's just a different culture from Southern California to Montana.
LaShawn George moved from San Diego to Missoula to get a college education and to play football.
Being a person of color, you know, I was a little bit apprehensive. My family was a little bit apprehensive about it, coaches even.
He was a receiver for 2 years before a rollover car accident ended his athletic career. He returned to California, and it took him 3 years to recover from two broken legs and other injuries. But he eventually came back to UM to finish his degree in community health. And that's when the absence of athletics pushed him into social activism.
There was a big gap, and I didn't want all that energy to just go to waste.
He got involved with several groups, including the Black Student Union, eventually becoming its president. That's where he joined forces with two other California students, Michaela Cox from the Los Angeles area and Kyle Davis from San Diego. The three share a mission to help educate Montanans about racial prejudice.
You know, that's Montana's biggest issue on race is ignorance. They don't know because there's not a lot of us here.
My interactions with a lot of people in Montana, it's just a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. They're not exposed to different cultures.
Davis says he understands where that comes from.
I've had classmates tell me, you know, I'm the first black person they've ever met or ever spoken to, and they're 20 years old.
Cox says that lack of exposure to other races can be the foundation for discrimination.
You're always being aware of how another person is perceiving you because you're always being perceived as other. As innocent as it is for little kids even, they will just stare. Sometimes they get afraid. They're not sure because I might be like the first black person they've ever seen.
That sort of behavior is called a microaggression, a comment or action that subtly and often unconsciously expresses a prejudice.
Like, you know, one that is a big topic people talk about is hair of black women. And, you know, people feel entitled to touch your hair, being followed, being watched while you're in a store. That's something that a white person wouldn't realize is happening to anyone else because it doesn't happen to you. And you, if you just went to a store with me, you might not even realize someone was doing that.
While a microaggression is unconscious behavior, the group has also seen macroaggressions, which are overt, hate-based attacks. George remembers walking on Orange Street in Missoula with a group of friends that included a white woman.
We're walking, she's behind me, we're just in a group, and somebody goes up to her and asks her, are you with that N-word, and calls her a bitch. It's actually projected itself to other people that I'm with.
And I think that our most powerful tool through all of this is education, as well as honesty.
UM student Dijiana Ahananu shared her story of macroaggressions at a Black Student Union event called Ask a Black Person.
Going out to my car one morning, and someone had left a note that said, run home monkey, with an upside down silhouette of Africa. And they proceeded to, for the next few days, around 1 a.m., maybe 3 the next day, my car alarm would be going off. I'm still paying off the damage to my car. It's kind of a constant thing.
Cox says Ahananu's story is difficult to hear, but sharing it is a crucial element in making progress.
It's very important for something like the Ask a Black Person panel, where you can come in and be like, okay, I can really ask like any question. Our hope was that people left there a lot more educated, a lot more insight on the black experience.
George says sharing personal experiences and asking uncomfortable questions is a way to get racism out in the open.
Brutally honest questions are the ones that everybody's thinking about, but everybody's trying to say in a nice way. Sometimes just say it.
A lot of people are willing to learn and are, whether they tell you it or not, they're seeking you to teach them.
There's so many different approaches to this. I strongly believe in education. I believe in dialogue. I believe in conversations.
We need to attack it as if, like, it is a disease and we're trying to get rid of it. If we approach racism like we did cancer, we'd be a lot more progressed than we are right now.
Cox, Davis, and George all say they're committed to pushing for that progress, no matter what state they end up in after college.
You have to change the way people think in order to change the way people act. At the end of the day, we're just asking for people to see the humanity in our communities.
So I try, you know, I try to make sure to, you know, represent us well and, you know, just be myself.
I have to be able to look my son in the eye and say I did something. I have to be able to look myself in the eye and say I did something.
And they hope that something can help encourage racial awareness in Montana. The ACLU of Montana says one area that needs work is the criminal justice system. Minorities are overrepresented there. You met Blackfeet and Assiniboine tribe member Dustin Monroe earlier. He says he's seen firsthand what can happen.
I got in trouble one time for a DUI, and I actually had the head prosecutor tell me, and she said, "We know about you people and what you people do when we let you out of here. You'll be back." Like, told me this, right? And I looked at her and I said, "You can't say this no more. This ain't 1945.
According to the Montana Department of Corrections, Native Americans make up about 20% of male inmates and about 34% of female inmates, even though Natives account for less than 7% of the state's population. American Civil Liberties Union of Montana Executive Director Caitlin Borgman says the percentages aren't reflective of the number of crimes committed.
It's because of their poverty, it's because of racism, it's because of structural racism in terms of how our state has been set up.
Former ACLU legal director Jim Taylor says the incarceration numbers have been high for a long time.
I mean, I've seen data going back 20 years, and there's been a consistent pattern of overrepresentation of minorities, especially Native Americans.
But he says the state numbers don't tell the whole story. They only represent cases off the reservations. Charges coming from 6 of Montana's 7 reservations go into the federal system.
It's over 30% of the people being prosecuted are Native American. So the numbers, as bad as they are in the Montana system, they underrepresent the actual nature of the problem. But there has to be a real serious look at implicit bias throughout the system, and no one's looking at it yet, no one's testing for it.
As you've heard, implicit bias is learned attitudes or stereotypes that affect understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious way. And some Montanans may experience that at school. According to research from the Center for Public Integrity, Montana is one of 19 states above the national average for referring minority students to police and the courts. That's not surprising for the University of Montana Indian Law Clinic co-director Maylin Smith.
Things that normally you would have got sent to the office for, now they're referred to your resource officer, which then gets them into the criminal justice system. They either are dropping out of school because of it, or they are getting into the juvenile justice system that then ends up filtering them into the justice system as adults.
Smith says she's seen implicit bias at work throughout the system.
You have the arrest, you have the officers who have the implicit bias. Then you get into the court system, you have the judges that have the implicit bias. You have the juries that are implicit bias. You have sentences that I think are often disproportionate for Indian people that reflects that implicit bias as well.
She says implicit bias also helps trap minorities in the justice system.
And you look at who's in there, most of them are in there on revocations. So that means that they have not been successful at reentry, and that is, again, because of a lot of that implicit bias, but it's also because they can't find housing.
That's what Dustin Monroe says happened to him. He says the court required him to stay in the Billings area after a DUI, even though he lived in Browning.
They're like, thought I was from Crow Reservation, so they're like, "You just stay here." And I was like, "No, they just basically made me homeless." So I was homeless and living in my car because I had nowhere else to go, and I had to sleep in a car for a couple months.
Despite that, Monroe completed his obligations to the court, but Smith says many others can't meet their obligations because of housing and transportation problems, and that often leads to parole or probation violations.
And so it's sort of that which comes first kind of thing. They end up couch surfing that then may end up getting them in more trouble. And so they keep cycling through the system, which then means they can't get housing, which often contributes to them getting back into the system.
Monroe says it can also be difficult to meet employment requirements.
I've had friends come out of the system that are Native American. They put us in the cities, and you're supposed to go get a job. Don't nobody hire you when you have a felony on your record. Don't care what crime you did.
Taylor says part of the problem is the way the system is set up.
The conditions that are put on people for probation and parole are designed for primarily for white urban people and for people that live on the reservation that have to travel long distances. The kinds of conditions they put on them are not designed to allow them to succeed.
But poverty also plays a role. Smith says Native American defendants often have to pay higher bonds to get out of jail.
So if you can't bond out, then that impacts several things. It impacts your ability for defense, but it also means you're more likely to plead guilty to something to get out, whether you've done it or not. That's incredibly common. I mean, I've already been in jail 5 days. That's what they'd sent me anyway. I might as well just plead guilty, not recognizing those collateral consequences.
Taylor says others make deals to plead guilty to lesser charges because they don't think they'll get fair treatment.
If you're a Native American defendant, you're going to trial in Havre or Cutbank or Lewistown, how confident are you that you're going to get a fair trial when there's probably not going to be any Native Americans on the jury panel?
Dustin Monroe says he's faced that exact situation.
Even if you're innocent, like I've been innocent on some things, and I've had to say I'm guilty because the system doesn't work for Indians here. Because like, if I was to actually go and try this out, I might go to prison or I might go to jail for like 2 months, right? So why would I go say that when I'm not gonna see any of my peers on that jury?
Because of jury makeup and all the other issues, Taylor says reforming the sprawling court system would be difficult, but critical.
At the end of the day, what you're trying to do is get people back on track. You're not just trying to punish them. We have to look at how they're getting in and when they're getting out and how they're monitored when they're out and how we can make it work better for everybody.
Deputy Corrections Director Cynthia Wolken is one of the people pushing to make the system work better. As a state senator in 2015, she sponsored a bill to set up the Montana Sentencing Commission.
And we really wanted to take a holistic view of our criminal justice system from entry to exit and figure out how we could spend taxpayer dollars more wisely and achieve better outcomes in all areas.
She sponsored 10 reform bills that came out of the Sentencing Commission during the 2017 legislative session. One of them created an interim study on increasing Native Americans' access to tribal resources as a way to curb reentry into the system.
We need to be supporting people better in their communities so they don't return to prison. And one of the things that we just know widely is that the more pro-social support somebody has, the more likely they are to stay out of prison. So as we continue to treat, unfortunately, substance abuse and mental health issues as criminal issues and not public health issues, we are gonna see people who are disproportionately affected by those issues in our criminal justice system.
Other bills from the commission created a housing grant program for some parolees, revised risk assessments before trial and during parole and probation, and reduced sentences for some nonviolent crimes. Wolken says the commission will monitor the changes and evaluate their effectiveness in lowering costs and in reducing the number of minorities in the system.
People are sort of coming together in this like very exciting way, and they want to work and help this succeed. So yes, I am at this point feeling positive.
Dustin Monroe says he's also feeling positive despite his experience with the court system.
I'm very hopeful. I think because like I'm able to actually have inroads with, you know, senators, I'm able to actually talk to people. I'm creating the questions. I don't want to be the face of change. I want to be part of the change.
One of those changes is playing out in a tribal defender's office. The attorneys and counselors there are providing more than just legal help for clients.
We're the public defender and we're here to help.
Ann Sherwood works as the managing attorney in the Defender's Office for the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribes in Pablo. She says part of the reason Native people are overrepresented in the justice system is because they often have trouble complying with court obligations.
The criminal charge itself might be a side issue to all that other stuff that falls out once you're charged with a crime. We know that something like 85% of our reentering clients have mental health and substance use disorders.
Since 2011, the Defender's Office has addressed the problem by offering an holistic defense program, modeled on one developed for the Bronx in New York. Holistic defense means the clinic offers its clients more than legal advice.
So, for instance, I may have a client who has a criminal charge pending in tribal court, but they may also have something pending in state court, might be a felony and a misdemeanor. That person might have gotten evicted for those criminal charges, so I may talk to one of our civil people about assisting with the eviction, and then there may be a Medicaid application that needs to be done. There may be mental health services that need to be in place, and we have people on our team that can assist with all of that.
One of those people is Ryan Anderson.
Big one there is housing.
He works with clients who are making the transition from prison back to their communities.
Big goal that we're constantly trying to work with is what we call the big three, and that's housing, employment, and then if there's any kind of treatment component that's necessary.
But he says a place to live is usually the toughest piece of the puzzle. Some of those defendants may have another option soon. The Montana legislature has approved a bill that creates a housing grant program with rental vouchers for those who qualify when they're leaving prison. The Defender's Office is also looking at a tool the justice system uses to assess how likely a person is to reoffend. It's called the Level of Service Inventory, or LSI.
We'll be looking at the LSI and seeing which of those factors are predictive of recidivism within the Native population.
That's Desiree Fox. She's a tribe member and a PhD student at the University of Montana. She works as a clinical psychology trainee at the Defender's Office.
And so what we'd like to do is create our own measure and then test that measure within this population.
The goal is to develop a risk assessment tool that's more predictive for Native Americans and that takes into account tribal ways.
What are their resilience factors? You know, what do they already have in place, either within the community or within themselves, that we can pull on as strengths that they can build off of?
For managing attorney Ann Sherwood, it's about establishing trust.
I've heard that people say they feel welcome here, that we're actually glad to see them when they walk through the door, and that motivates them to come and get services. And we're here to come up with solutions. So not only does it establish trust among our clients, which is, of course, our priority, but it also establishes trust among decision makers, because we're not then perceived as part of the problem. We're actually part of the solution, since we're trying to address those issues that bring people into the criminal justice system.
Sherwood and her team are also part of a University of Montana study to determine why Native American women make up about a third of the total population at the Women's State Prison. Several groups are working outside the justice system to end racial friction in Montana. Their tools are community workshops and presentations for schools, businesses, and government. The goal is to adjust the lenses we use to view minorities and to begin seeing them as neighbors rather than outsiders.
Okay, everybody, let's wrap it up and come back into our semicircle.
Judith Heilman is leading a workshop called Dismantling Hate in a meeting room at a Bozeman hotel.
You know, I wanted to ask you guys, raise your hand if you had trouble identifying 1, 2, and 3.
About a dozen people have gathered on a Saturday morning to talk about race. The training is the signature course for the Montana Racial Equity Project, which Heilman founded in 2015.
These people want to learn these things and want to learn how to interrupt racism and bigotry and prejudice in a peaceful manner whenever they see, hear, or read it.
Heilman grew up in Palo Alto, California, and worked as a police officer there for 13 years. She moved to Montana after retiring and became the state director for the group Every Town for Gun Safety. She says what changed her path was serving on a shootings review team for the organization.
When I've seen people of color getting killed and assaulted across the United States by civilians and by law enforcement, that kind of a thing is just, it's system-wide and it's endemic and it's very frustrating and something's got to be done about it. We have to face that every single person on this planet has implicit and explicit bias. We all have our prejudices about such a variety of things, not just people. But the really important thing is to just be able to become aware of them and to keep them in check.
But Heilman says some Montanans are in denial about racism.
I continue to say it because I continue to hear it from many, many white Montanans that there's no racism in Montana because there aren't any minorities. That's untrue.
Part of the training tries to help the group see through the eyes of Montanans who are in the minority.
For people who want to learn more about what prejudice, bigotry, and racism are, what discrimination is,
Heilman is always looking for volunteers as the demand for workshops grows.
I'm really passionate about social justice, and so I sort of started by just following the Facebook page.
Aspen Haugen thought she'd volunteer to set up tables, but Heilman had her managing the group's social media, and now she helps teach the workshops.
It feels like I'm really working on something that is making a difference where I am. Growing up in Bozeman, the impression that I had of the town was that it was very white, very racially homogenous. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that that is not an accurate depiction of what the town was ever really like.
Haugen says she thinks tapping into bedrock Montana values may be the key to breaking down racial barriers.
Montanans are big on this idea, right, of neighborliness. If you can get Montanans to acknowledge that their neighbors are also people who are different from them, I think that you're already a huge part of the way.
So what I would like you to do is break up into groups of threes again.
I will tell you that I just get so much out of doing these workshops. There's just so much to be done.
Heilman says she hopes the people she just spent 6 hours with will become part of her grassroots movement, and many of them sound like they're up to the challenge.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I am, I guess, well-informed enough to put up a good fight, and it's my responsibility to use that.
I wanted to be able to answer people that make racist statements.
Haugen says she hopes her generation will be the one to lead the way.
The sort of old-fashioned sort of mentality is, you know, if you don't like Montana, get out of it. And I think that there's a growing realization, especially among younger people from Montana, that we have permission to change Montana for the better.
It's that willingness to grow and change that Heilman is counting on.
Person by person, bit by bit, we can communicate to one another that prejudice, bigotry, and racism is not all right, that they're very real, that stopping those things is not a threat to white Americans. It's actually something that helps us all in our shared humanity. It's fair and it's just.
In Missoula, the group Empower Montana is doing similar work. It focuses on leadership development as a key to improving race relations, and a lot of the work is with students.
Have a good time, safe time, and we're going to be talking about youth homelessness tonight. So,
a couple dozen teens and adults gather outside Holy Spirit Episcopal Church in Missoula. They've set up their tents to spend the night, to hold a teach-in, and to fill care packages. It's part of the group's annual celebration of diversity.
Really, our goal is just to make everybody feel accepted and welcomed in our community.
Lily Allred is a Hellgate High School student who works with the group's youth community. She says the work is about changing attitudes.
I feel like if you educate people and you teach them how to treat people with respect and treat them how you would like to be treated, I think that can change.
Students in the program learn how to calmly confront racism and other oppression when they see it.
I've seen the N-word thrown around by white kids.
That's Jared Burkhart. He's a student at Willard High School.
I feel like it comes out of miseducation because what goes on in a lot of people's heads is wow, slavery was 325 some years ago. I think it's fine to say the N-word now. It's all smoothed over. There's no more oppression, but that's false.
He says the most important thing is to show compassion when confronting oppression.
I've heard like people say the N-word around like people of color, and I was like, hey, don't do that.
I'll be walking down the hall and somebody will say something about like a refugee that goes to school with us.
Uriah Hardy goes to Big Sky High School.
I don't really think anyone grows up thinking that they need to hate people, but I think that part of the way that they were raised or by the experiences that they've had, that they just think a certain thing about a certain person.
Empower Montana Operations Director Jesse Jager says that lack of experience with different racial groups leads some residents to dismiss the problem.
And we have a pretty fraught relationship with race that goes back to years. And it's not just even with Native Americans. I mean, Missoula was the home of a internment camp during World War II of Japanese. So it's a dynamic that's in the bloodstream of Montana.
But he says he's seen how students have pushed back against that dynamic at a Missoula high school.
There was some pretty insensitive racial comments made in the classroom by a teacher. And what happened was there's some of our youth that been through our trainings were able to address that. They knew what to do. They went to educators and administrators who had been through our trainings who also knew how to work through that issue.
Empower Montana Executive Director Heidi Wallace sees the post-election period as a good time to confront the issues.
So we see it as a perfect opportunity to continue the work that we do, which is create spaces for people to have conversations, to get a deeper understanding about different groups, the impact of oppression.
Jager says it's an opportunity for discussion that the state needs.
Where it's up in front of us in a much more explicit way. And that allows us to have those deeper conversations and say, hey, the super racist comment you just heard is important. We need to talk about that. But let's also talk about those subtler systemic pieces of racism that are happening every day in our community.
He says that many Montanans are unaware of the unconscious forms of racism because they've grown up in a system of white privilege.
Privilege is really hard to see, right? Because part of the fabric of privilege is it sets the normative, like what is supposed to be normal in our society. And when that's, it's kind of like being a fish in water, right? If you're a fish in water, you don't know there's water around you all the time until you're out of it. And that's kind of how privilege works. And our job is to shine a light on that.
It's not about shaming and blaming and humiliating people. It's about helping folks understand.
Wallace says many people make the wrong decision when they come up against friends or family who exhibit racist behavior.
They're so racist, you know, I'm not going to be like, I'm going to push them away. I don't want them around me. When as white identity people, those are the people we need to bring closer, and we need to figure a way to engage, to educate, to connect. Because if not, who will?
You know, I think it's so easy to unfriend the person on Facebook that says the racist thing.
Wallace says the demand for their workshops is growing. Last year, they had 38 bookings during a single month.
Is there another adult that's staying for the night?
And a lot of that work is with students like the ones camping out at Holy Spirit Episcopal Church.
Our job is to help develop those leaders that can go out and make that systemic change.
Tonight, as Big Sky High School student Uriah Hardy and others tackle the problem of teen homelessness, he's also aware of the bigger picture.
I hope that a lot of the things that we do here with Empower Montana doesn't have to be an issue in the future.
Facing Race was made possible through the support of the University of Montana and its School of Journalism. I'm Ray Fanning.